Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Nicholas Thompson on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzsche, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. I actually met George Kennan on two occasions. I believe the first time was in 1983, and he was spry. And then I also met him in the late 90s, in which he was rather hobbled. On both occasions, it struck me that he was a very dignified person, but a kind of an odd person as well. I think that both of these characteristics come out in Nicholas's wonderful book, and we get to learn a lot about Paul Nitzsche as well. And we get to hear the entire history of the Cold War as told in this remarkable twin biography. We can see how the lives of these two really very interesting and complicated men weave in and out of the story, which is that of the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. So without further ado, here is the interview. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well today. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa. How is it in New York City?
Overcast and sort of nasty.
I'm sorry to hear that. That will not foreshadow anything in this interview. I should tell our listeners that we have Nicholas Thompson on the show, and we will be talking about his new book, The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzsche, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. I was telling Nicholas in the pre-interview that I think that the book is really very beautifully written. Nicholas is quite a stylist. We should have him talk to large groups of academic historians to explain to us how we might write better, because there are lots and lots of pithy, quotable sentences in the book. It has an interesting narrative line. It's not exactly linear. It weaves in the life of two different people going back and forth, but not in a regular pattern, so you don't really ever know what's coming next. So anyway, it's a for those of you that like history, I think it's a terrific read, and I hope that the book finds a large readership. So having said all that, by way of introduction, Nicholas, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, that was an awfully kind introduction.
It's all true.
I'm an editor at Wired Magazine. It's my day job. And I spent the last 4 years writing this book. Nitzsche was my grandfather. And the idea of the book was to tell the story of the Cold War through characters. Most history of the Cold Wars are written episodically. You know, there's a section on the Korean War, and there's a section on the Vietnam War. And I thought, well, what about trying to tell it through people? And there are really only two people who are prominent at the very beginning of the Cold War, influential throughout it, and then whose careers wrap up at the end of the Cold War. They're really, both Nitzsche and Kennan are there at the very beginning, there at the very end. Their working careers span the Cold War almost exactly. And then there are a few other elements that made it a good story. One is that they're friends. Two is that they're profound rivals. Each believed that the other's strategy was likely to blow up the world. And then third, as Nitzsche's grandson, I, of course, had access to all sorts of documents and to people who were willing to talk to me who wouldn't have been willing to speak with me otherwise. So that's the basic idea of the book, and I can tell you a lot more about the details of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just a little bit, because many of the people that listen to this show, I think, are professional historians. Most of them aren't, of course, but still, we're always interested in sources, and you say you had access to Nitzsche's papers. Where are Nitzsche's papers now?
Well, okay, there are a couple of collections that I had access to. I, of course, used papers at the National Archives, all sorts of collections at libraries around the country were sort of a secondary value to me. But the collections that were a real value to me were Nitzsche's official papers, which are at the Library of Congress, which are closed, which you need permission to see. But I actually am in charge of who gets permission, so if you're listening now, you can have permission. That was sort of collection one. Collection two, which was even more interesting, I was looking at a small set of papers, maybe four or five boxes, that were held by a professor at SAIS, the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I went in there one Saturday, and I said to the janitor here, there's nobody else around, I'm here to see the Nitzsche papers. He take me to the sixth floor. And he didn't really speak English, and I didn't really speak very good Spanish. He ended up taking me to the fourth floor. I said, okay, well, might as well go with him, see what happens. He opens the elevator, turns right, walks down this hallway, unlocks a door, and in there, there's a giant blue boiler. And behind it are 60 or 70 boxes. Mm. And those are apparently my grandfather's personal papers that he just left at site. Someone at some point moved them behind the boiler. Nobody knew they were there except for this janitor, not even the dean.
Wow.
And in these papers, you know, are handwritten notes in the Cuban Missile Crisis. mm-hmm. handwritten notes from the Berlin crisis, my grandfather's notes on Reykjavik, letters from his mother, all sorts of things that were really important to the book. So those papers I spent, you know, weeks behind the boiler. I set up a little desk going through the boxes. And then I, when I finished my project, I gave all of those to the Library of Congress. So those are being sorted right now and will mm-hmm. be available to the public in not so long. Mm-hmm. The third collection that was extremely important to me is that Kennan's family opened up his personal papers and diaries. Kennan had a lot of papers at the Mudd Library at Princeton, and I, of course, went through those, the regular collection that have been used for the, you know, several very good biographies that have been written about Kennan. But then I was also given access to all of these private, long, closed papers. So I had John Lewis Gaddis has had access to them, and I had access to them.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as of this year, they've all been made public.
Mm-hmm.
And there even, I learned last night I was down in Princeton giving a talk, and I learned that there's even a few more boxes that I didn't get to see that have been made public, including Kennan's dream diary. So if there are historians listening to this right now, you should go to Mudd Library and check out the dream diary. I'm utterly intrigued what's in there. So those are really the three collections that were most important to me.
That's interesting. And where are Kennan's papers today? They're mostly at Princeton then?
They're all at Princeton, yep.
I see, okay.
I mean, there are obviously some papers in the policy planning staff files at the National Archives there. You know, there's a very interesting collection, you know, C. Ben Wright's papers that are at the Marshall Library in Lexington, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So they're good Kennan papers there, but the best material, the most original material, his diaries, his personal letters, all of that stuff, that's all at Princeton.
That's interesting. So that's there's material there for many, many dissertations and good books. So
oh, absolutely, yeah, and I look forward to reading them.
Yeah. The other thing that you did that I was interested to see, and I'm always intrigued at this because as I was trained as a medievalist, and all those people, well, they're dead. So you went, you interviewed pretty much everybody everywhere. The list of people you interviewed is truly incredible. How did you get that list, and how did you approach them, and who are they?
Well, what's interesting is that for me, you know, my training is as a journalist, so interviewing was a skill set I'd already developed, whereas historical and documentary research was something I hadn't done as much of. So it was actually sort of harder for me to learn how to be efficient in the National Archives than it was to, you know, find everybody who was connected to Nitze and Kennan in different parts of their lives and then just feel comfortable calling them and visiting them. So I went through and I organized the book into scenes, and I started, my structure was I began with, you know, one large word file that was a chronological list of scenes, important episodes, and important moments. And then I would sort of think through each scene and think, is there anybody who is involved in it who's alive today? And if they are, I would call them or write them and try to set up an interview, ideally in person, sometimes by phone. And I ended up meeting, you know, just an amazing group of people. And this is where being Nitze's grandson really helped. And people who knew my grandfather, there were lots of them, were willing to talk. But I met, I mean, some of my favorite interviews. I had a wonderful interview with Martha Mottner, who worked in the embassy in Moscow with Kennan in the 1940s. And she's this frail old lady with wonderful memories. One of the first people I interviewed was Robert Bowie, who's now... now 99. He was the head of the policy planning staff after Nitze and Kennan. I spent a lot of time with Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and people who are quite prominent, who normally wouldn't, you know, talk to just any journalist, but were willing to talk to me for this project.
Mm-hmm. Talk to Richard Pipes?
I did talk to Richard Pipes. I went and talked to him. I believe I interviewed him at least twice.
Yeah, no, I remember that actually, because I remember it in the book. You mentioned it in the book. Yeah.
He was very important in the Team B episode and my grandfather in the 1970s. And he, of course, I mean, there were also people, you know, I wanted to interview people who knew Nitze, who knew Kennan, who were involved in these scenes. And then there were also people who just know a lot about the period. So Pipes, in addition to his specific memories, he knew both Nitze and Kennan. Was very helpful in helping me understand the dynamic of Soviet-American relationships and his view on this, which, you know, a lot of people dispute, a lot of people agree with, but I wasn't trying to pick sides. I was trying to learn from everybody. So I talked to all sorts of people like that.
Mm-hmm. That was quite amazing. Must have been an amazing experience to talk to all those people. And you went to Moscow, is that correct?
I did go to Moscow, and I went to – my goal there was to talk to as many people as I could who knew Nitze and Kennan to get the Soviet perspective. And mostly mostly I talked to people who had been arms negotiators with my grandfather, so people who had negotiated the Salt One Agreement or the INF Treaty, or who had been there at Reykjavik, or who were there at the later INF negotiations. And that was very interesting to get the perspective of them. And then, of course, I also wanted to ask them, tell me what were the Soviets thinking during the Cuban Missile Crisis, or the Caribbean Crisis, as they call it, and to try to get as much as I could, both because it's interesting and because my goal was for sort of every paragraph or every page to have something to have something new, to have something fresh, to have something interesting. And of course, I didn't succeed on that. But there, it's a lot easier to get new and fresh material if you're talking to people on the Soviet side because they haven't been interviewed so many times and for so many previous books.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about that. Especially, you know, having worked in journalism a little bit myself, I know that people that have been interviewed more than I think three times have a certain set of sentences that they can spit out without even thinking.
Well, and it's even worse than that, is that a lot of times people will prepare for their interview with you by rereading the same text they read, or they'll read, you know, they'll read Nitze's memoirs before the interview with you about Nitze, at which point they're just sort of recounting the story there. And you can understand that because it's a way to sort of reinforce and recreate those memories, but it's not helpful. So the job in the interview is to try to, you know, to pull them out of that somehow, to tell them about other episodes or to sort of maybe surprise them with a question that leads them to tell you something interesting and new. And that's, you know, that's hard. And sometimes I had success with that, and a lot of times I didn't.
I'm amazed that you were able to hold a day job while you wrote this book because, I mean, it's a terrific book, and also working in day job, that's tough. So, I admire
well,
you
I took,
on that.
I took 6 months off.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I had my wife got pregnant, and I had a baby coming, and I realized that there was no way I could do the book, hold down the job, and raise a child. So I had to really rush. Not rush, but I had to pick up the pace quite a bit. So I took 6 months off, and I got, you know, in that six-month period, I got from, you know, from World War II to the Reagan administration.
Still quite an achievement, I think.
So that was very important that I did that.
So let's actually talk about these two characters.
Yeah.
Let's begin by talking about Nitze. And where was he from exactly? What was his background? He had kind of an adventuresome youth.
He had very adventuresome youth. He grew up in Chicago. His father was a sort of world-famous philologist, William A. Nitze, who's written classic texts on French literature. And his family had a very strong German connection. So he grows up there. Around the University of Chicago, where his father is a professor. He's sort of a rambunctious kid. He joins a street gang. He plays lots of football, but, you know, isn't that good at it. He finishes his high school requirements very early. He goes to Hotchkiss because his father thinks he's too young to go to college. He's not very happy there. The memory he seems to like the most is a summer he spends working on a boat sailing across the Atlantic. Then he goes to Harvard. And at Harvard, he's kind of, you know, there aren't frats, but he's basically a frat boy. He parties a lot, you know, he probably, you know, he runs naked up and down Massachusetts Avenue, and he doesn't really get it together. I mean, he's a smart guy, of course, and he ends up graduating with distinction or something, but he also almost flunks out at one point. There's a terrible accident where he runs somebody over driving, he may have been drunk. I mean, it's a sort of a wayward youth, not completely. I mean, he still manages to get through Harvard, but it's not a disciplined and focused life. And then in his 20s, he goes to Wall Street, and he meets Clarence Dillon. And through sort of a family connection, he goes in to see Dillon. And this is it's meeting Dillon and meeting James Forrestal, who's working at Dillon Reed. And that's where Nitze starts to focus. And that's where they say, look, you know, you're a young guy. You're clearly talented, but you have no idea what you're talking about. And you're not going to get through this, and you're not going to succeed on charm and wit and sort of the charisma that get you to succeed and get you into the Porcellian Club. You're actually going to have to do stuff. Uh-huh. And so this is where Nitze learns how to work, and this is where Nitze becomes efficient. He ends up, he claims to be the last man hired before the Great Depression, before the stock market crash in 29. I don't know if that's true, but there's some truth to it. He was hired right before the crash. He comes on, and yet he still makes money during the Depression. He still does well. So that's Nitze's beginning.
Let me just pause there for a second and ask you about a couple things that caught my attention. I knew a little bit about Nitze's biography prior to this. Mostly I knew about the Team B stuff. But this early incident in which he, I don't know what happens, but there is an auto accident. He is driving, and he runs a couple of people over, and one of them dies.
Yeah.
What exactly happened there? And he seems to have settled this. I don't really understand how it was. He wasn't prosecuted for anything. He ends up settling with them. There's a civil suit or something? Maybe you could explain a little bit about this.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, I didn't get the court records. I went back and checked, and we had librarians in Boston trying to figure it out. What we know is that he's dating this, I think it's Mary Ames, who's part of the, you know, famous Boston Ames family. They're sort of a hard partying, so highly respected social circle. They're going out one night. They're going around a corner on Beacon Street, and they run two people over. One of whom dies, and the other of whom has, you know, fractured something or other. And it's unclear. You know, he writes letters home. What I've seen are the letters home to his parents. And the letters say, you know, there's been a horrible accident. These people ran in front of the car. It was terrible. The one person has died mostly from shock. You know, we've done everything we could to try to help out. And so there's that. But there's also, you know, sort of signs of carelessness. There's also letters from Mary. But what you also see is you see in the very beginning, you see kind of a cold, non-emotional reaction. But then later in the letter chain, you start seeing letters from Mary to him saying, I'm so proud of what you've done during this. I'm so proud about how you've stood strong during this ordeal. And there are a few letters from his lawyer that I've seen where it says, you know, this could be a serious problem. We don't want it to go in front of a jury. You're completely innocent, but what will a Boston jury think of this Harvard student who's done this thing? So it's a very there's a bunch of fragmented evidence, but it looks like what happened is there was a bad accident. He was probably somewhat at fault. He probably was acting reckless, but it wasn't sort of an obvious case of drunk and disorderly, you know, total buffoonery. And they end up settling out of court, and he ends up paying a certain amount of money to the families, and it it then disappears. And I had, you know, I'm his grandson. I didn't know a thing about it until I got into the letters.
It's funny. I found out something like that about my grandfather. He nothing on this level. He wasn't involved in a death, but he was basically an unindicted co-conspirator in a grain fraud sort of thing in Kansas, where I'm from. I never knew this about him until he died, and I was like, yeah, he was the Al Capone of grain.
Wow, that's interesting.
Something like that. I don't know. I never really looked into it. But anyway, the second thing I wanted to ask about was, or maybe point out to the listeners, is this was an interesting moment for me, is that he enters a circle of people at Harvard in something called the Porcellian Club, and we should tell people that don't know what that is. This is one of the, they're called finals clubs at Harvard, and they used to be something of quite, they marked a certain amount of distinction. You were of a certain kind. I don't know, the people of old blue blood families got into them, and it wasn't really exactly from a blue blood family, but yeah. He knew people that were. And so he goes to this club, but you describe some things in the book, some scenes at which he's surrounded by people who will later run the United States, basically.
Right. And they're all, you know, all sorts of senators and treasury secretaries. He becomes very good friends in the club with Chip Boland, who, of course, becomes Roosevelt's translator at Yalta. He becomes good friends with Joseph Alsop, the, you know, prominent journalist through the club. It's a great networking tool. And I think that's, you know, despite his sort of wayward, unfocused sense, that he certainly makes connections who will be important to him throughout his career and life.
This is how he gets to Wall Street. I mean, he goes with a letter of recommendation from I forget whom exactly, and I think people don't understand what letters of recommendation used to be, because now the currency has been devalued significantly.
Right, now, with the letters of introduction, you know,
the introduction,
Dillon,
yeah,
meet with
exactly,
this young man, you know,
yeah,
I'm a friend of yours, meet
exactly,
with this young,
that,
promising Mr. Nitzer.
That was really worth quite a lot, and so he gets into Wall Street that way, and he joins the investment banking world.
He joins the investment banking world, yeah. Dillon Reed, and this is where he makes his most important contact of those years, which is
Forrestal,
Jim Forrestal.
Yeah, exactly. So then let's go to Kennan. Explain his background to us.
So Kennan grows up in Milwaukee, and he has a much harder youth. You know, Nitzer has parents overwhelmingly love him. Kennan has four older sisters, and his mother dies right after he's born. There's some complications there. It's not related to birth, but I think it's appendicitis. I'm not exactly sure how she dies, but
yeah,
she dies in some sort of terrible way.
Yeah, tragically.
Tragically after her son is born. So he grows up with a stepmother who doesn't really like him, a father who's distant, and a house that, you know, fittingly, my favorite detail about it is that they put the windows on the wrong side of the house, so instead of facing the yard, the windows face another building.
Mm.
So it's a very dark and somber house. Kennan grows up, and he's quiet, withdrawn, very thoughtful. One of my favorite facts is that in his high school yearbook, they list pet peeves, and Kennan's pet peeve is the universe. He writes poetry, and it's kind of dark and somber, but beautiful and amazing. He's clearly an exceptionally bright kid. He's sent off to military academy at one point, runs away, hates it. And then he goes to Princeton. And Princeton is, he's not well off at all. He's a relatively, for Princeton at that time, he's not an affluent guy. He shows up at Princeton, and he doesn't fit in. He's an outcast. He joins an eating club, you know, the key to social success at Princeton, very briefly, and then leaves it. He decides that he doesn't want to be that. He's too proud to be a member of an eating club, so he joins the dining hall for the rejects. And he sits at a table by himself, just showing that he can grin and bear it. And so it's a very, very cold, sort of unhappy period in his life. But then he leaves Princeton, and one the key thing in Kennan's life is that he believes he's something of a reincarnation of his great, or I guess his uncle's cousin. There's a slightly complicated relationship, but there's a predecessor, also named George Kennan. He's a great explorer of Russia, and he writes these very important books in the early 20th century about Russia and exploring Siberia. And Kennan, you know, has the same birthday, the same name, thinks he's got some spiritual connection to this older George Kennan. So the young George Kennan decides to go into the Foreign Service, and he decides to learn Russian. And this is how his career begins. And he really starts to blossom intellectually. He's kind of a B student at Princeton. He's not very well remembered. There aren't, you know, friends of his who will later write about what he was like. But once he eventually gets to Russia, once we normalize relationships, once it opens up and he's there in the early 1930s, then this is where he starts to blossom and become the man we would all later be well aware of.
Kennan, at this point, let's talk about the 30s a little bit, because Kennan's career takes off, I think, at this point. He becomes a somebody in the diplomatic corps, whereas Nitze is, what is Nitze doing? Is he floundering?
He's still on Wall Street.
Yeah.
I mean, Kennan's, both of them in the 1930s, you know, neither becomes famous, neither becomes truly important, neither is, you know, mentioned in the New York Times, but both have very important intellectual development. For Nitze in the 1930s, it's about learning the way finance works. It's about learning how to get things done. For Kennan, it's about learning the way the world works. It's about learning languages. It's about learning about Stalin. So they get through the 1930s. They both become sort of very intellectually competent people. Nitze's route into government is kind of tangential. So Nitze, by the end of the 1930s, he's kind of had it with finance. Spent too much time on Wall Street, and you know, he thinks there are bigger questions out there. You know, this is probably his father's influence. His father,
and money is no longer an issue for him at this. He's
money's
well,
no longer an issue. He's married well. He's made money. He's got what he needs. So, I think it's in 1939. He decides he's going to go back to Harvard and he's going to study the great questions. He's going to learn what life is about.
Mm-hmm.
So he leaves banking, goes to Harvard, spends 6 months, doesn't figure it out. Comes back, decides he wants to start Paulichnitz and Company, his own firm, but he doesn't really like it. So he's kind of stuck. What do I do with my life? Then James Forrestal is brought in by Franklin Roosevelt, and he's going to be the liaison between the government and the business community. And Forrestal, you know, says, well, if I'm going to do this, I need a young aide. I need Paul Nitze. So he sends in this telegram, and it says, you know, be in Washington Monday, Forrestal. Mm-hmm. Nitze gets it while he's working on some business deal down in Louisiana. And, you know, that's it. That's the beginning. So, you know, that takes Nitze to Washington, and he will not leave for 64 years. Kennan, he works in the diplomatic corps. He rises very quickly. He rises faster than almost anybody else in his class. He goes up. He's clearly brilliant. He can clearly understand what's happening in Russia. He sees through Stalin and the purges. You know, he's a translator for Joseph Davies, the ambassador, who's sort of a Stalin supplicant who doesn't understand what's going on. But Kennan really becomes prominent. So Kennan sort of carves out this position where he's very critical of Russia. He's very critical of Stalin. And this, of course, is during World War II, where Stalin is our great ally. And so while Stalin is considered Uncle Joe to everybody else back in America, Kennan is saying, hey, you know, Russian history shows that we're never going to get along with this guy. So Kennan, he takes this position from being a very smart person whose name nobody knows to suddenly becoming one of the most prominent people around when he writes what's called the Long Telegram,
mm-hmm.
which most of the people listening to this will know. And this is his famous document in February 46. So early in that month, Stalin gives a very aggressive speech at the Bolshoi Theater in America. You know, the State Department cables to Kennan and says, why is Stalin being so aggressive? Why won't the Soviets join the IMF? You know, what is going on? They were our friends. And so Kennan says, and he writes this long memo. And one of my favorite stories of the book is, you know, the night of this memo. This
mm-hmm.
is where
yeah,
the woman I mentioned, Martha Mottner, comes in, and she's this 22-year-old working in the code room, and she's there. She's got a date that evening. So Kennan comes down. You know, the tall figure of George Kennan comes down. And he has this long stack of papers. And he says to Mottner, he says, I've got this. I've got this telegram. It's very important. You have to send it. And she looks at it. She tells me the story. And she looks at it, and she reads it, and she says, oh, I understand this. And she says, you've said all this already. Does it have to go out? And Kennan says, yes, it must go out. And so she takes it and she sends it, and she's sort of late to her dance party.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the Long Telegram. That's the document that transforms the way that Americans think of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back, it's given to James Forrestal, and then it's given to everybody else in government, it's passed around. And suddenly, here's this explanation. Here's why Stalin is not, you know, not our friend, is not working with us. Here's what's happening with foreign relations. And Kennan, this brilliant guy who knows Russian history, who understands this, and so suddenly he's hugely in demand. American foreign policy starts to shift. Kennan is summoned back. And this person who, in January 1946, nobody knows his name, is made the head of the Hollis planning staff. He's the guy who has to come up with the big thoughts and guide Truman, Marshall, and Acheson through these very crucial years post-World War II.
So before we actually move on a little bit, and I want to talk about what NHTSA does during World War II, because I find it truly amazing.
Yeah.
I found myself being very envious of his. he has a really neat, I don't know, it's been horrible, but a really incredible adventure in the closing.
I mean, NHTSA's life is full of adventures.
Yeah,
really. One of my favorite emails, I got an email from a friend the other day who had read the book, and he said, you know, I want to write like Kennan and live like NHTSA.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's pretty much it. So there is one moment I never really read a Kennan biography before, but there was one moment that quite surprised me because it was contrary to the way we ordinarily think about Kennan, at least that I thought about Kennan, and that's this essay that he wrote in 1935 or 7?
Right.
37. Yeah, and this essay, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the essay and the context in which it was written and what it says.
Yeah, the essay is horrible. It's called The Prerequisites. Kennan is living, he's back from serving abroad, and he's living in Alexandria, and he's come back after being away. He doesn't really know his country, and he comes back and he sees billboards, and he sees, you know, the influence of corporations, and he sees, you know, Congress is inefficient, and things that people have sort of complained about forever and are complaining about today and will complain about, you know, for a long time. And Kennan just thinks the country is going to hell, and that what we really need to do is to have a, you know, group of Kennan's favorite form of government. The back of his mind, and sometimes, you know, towards the front of his mind, was always benevolent dictatorship. He always wanted America to be run by a small group of people, or, you know, maybe one person who had the best interest in mind, and who would make the sort of the hard, tough decisions that this messy, clumsy democracy could never figure out. And so, in this essay, he basically says, you know, we need to disenfranchise African Americans. We need to disenfranchise women. It's just creating chaos, and, you know, they have no idea what's happening. And we need a small group of highly educated people, and you can imagine who they were. They would be, you know, people like George Kennan, highly educated, highly dedicated people who, you know, served abroad. You know, Kennan would probably try to appoint NHTSA, though NHTSA would have found the whole thing so horrible. And, you know, we should recast government to have basically a benevolent dictatorship where I have a prominent role. And he writes this essay, which thankfully he then stuffs in his papers. And it's not, you know, uncovered for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really, I mean, Kennan has a, I mean, this is something that I learned while reading his diaries, while reading his personal notes. He has a very dark side, and the dark side is comprised of, you know, fundamental dislike of democracy, the sense that this political system is profoundly flawed, lack of tolerance for other people, particularly people of other races, genders, religious views. He believed that, you know, this country was, you know, built by hardworking, you know, Midwestern people and New Englanders with, you know, tough skin who, you know, could work through the cold winters, and, you know, they built this wonderful country and they should continue to push it. And that's, you know, at the end of his life, he was sort of in favor of Vermont secessionism. I mean, there's a line that you can draw through that's, you know, very dark. And fortunately, this didn't come out. And it would have ruined George Kennan, and you would have missed all the sort of the very smart and wonderful things he did for this country and all the, you know, brilliant things he wrote. He, you know, there's an essay, or there's a description of him in Joseph Alsop's autobiography, where he says that Kennan is like the Oracle of Delphi, and sometimes you would speak the, you know, the most profound truth, and the other half would speak the most profound gibberish. You know, there's nothing in between. It's either brilliance or just absolutely and completely wrong, which is partly why he's such an interesting biographical study. I mean, he's an amazing, fascinating character who has this dark, very, very, you know, the side that it's hard to respect to like, and you can read these essays or diary entries of Kennan, and you're just, this man is repulsive. And then you read other things, and you think, my God, this is one of the most brilliant writers and thinkers I've ever seen. So it's a very complicated character.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. I think that it's always interesting to take our contemporary image of someone, particularly if we have lionized them in some way, as many people have lionized Kennan, and then look at all of their views. Because what we find out almost always is that they held views that by our lights are completely retrograde. And this isn't just Kennan. I mean, I think it's almost everybody.
But my
favorite example is someone like Lincoln, who, you know, he freed the slaves and so on and so forth, but he didn't really think much of Africans. And that's very clear in the record. But it is more so with Kennan, because this is a really peculiar, one almost wants to say fascist sort of essay. I had never heard of it, and I'm not quite sure what to think about it. It's a very strange thing. But anyway, let's go on with Knitzen. We'll talk about what he does during World War II, and especially the close of World War II is particularly fascinating.
Yeah, so, I mean, he works sort of in minerals procurement. He has all sorts of jobs in Washington. But what he does at the close of World War II is he joins the Strategic Bombing Survey, and his job is to – he speaks German. It's to go to Germany, and it's to find ex-Nazi leaders and to interview them. And the person he spends the most time with is Albert Speer. And there are these long, sort of amazing transcripts. I mean, I wish I could have written more about him in the book, but these long conversations where Nitze, along with John Kenneth Galbraith and George Ball, they're interviewing Speer, and they're asking, you know, this bombing attack on this particular day, what did it do? And Speer knows everything. And he tells us these amazing things like, I didn't want you to hit these factories. I wanted to hit these other factories. So we put these other factories that we thought you cared about, that we didn't care about, you know, put them in obvious places so it'd be easy for you to destroy. But really the stuff we needed to do, we hid in these ways. And you didn't quite figure it out, and you should have bombed this way and that way or this way and that way. And Nitze has this incredible education, both on understanding the specifics of that war, but also how strategic bombing can be played out. We often think that, okay, this many planes flew and dropped this many bombs and blew up this many things. And what Speer was saying is that actually it makes a huge difference whether you're blowing up, you know, tire plants or whether you're blowing up ball bearing factories, and some really matter to the war production effort and some don't. Mm-hmm. And so Nitze starts to understand and starts to think through all this. So that's sort of step one. He finishes with Germany, he finishes with Speer. Actually, the last night he's told that, okay, Speer's going to be arrested the next day. You have one more interview. And so the last interview, Nitze says, okay, Speer, you know, says, Mr. Speer, forget all this stuff. I don't want to hear about the bombing anymore. I want to know about Hitler, and I want to know what it was like. And so that's when you get the sort of all the stories that end up in Hugh Trevor Roper's amazing book about the last days of the Third Reich and the chaos and the bunkers and the mayhem. And so Nitze gets all that stuff, and it's spellbinding. His next step is he's sent to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he's there. He's one of the first Americans who lands after the bombs. And his job, as he writes in his memoirs, is to put calipers on the destruction, to try to understand what happened. Why did some buildings fall, and why did some buildings stand? And he has these memories that are really important to him, and that he sort of latches onto about, for example, people in a train in Nagasaki. The people who are near closed windows when the bomb goes off, they get cut by the glass, and it seems bad at first. People near the open windows are more likely to die of radiation exposure. And so it's all these sort of complicated ways of looking at nuclear bombs and the effects of nuclear bombs. And his thesis is that these weapons are not supernatural. They're not things that were created by God. They were created by man. And they have blast effects, and they have radiation effects, and they have explosive effects. And we can understand all these things. And we can, in some good ways and in some bad ways, learn how to attack others, you know, the lessons from Speer. And we can learn how to defend ourselves. And so he really starts to get inside sort of the world of mass destruction, what it means and what it doesn't mean. And that begins a lifelong inquiry into these questions, and that's what will dominate his career and his life.
Mm-hmm. I see. So how does he I know what happens to Kennan. What happens to Nitze right after the war? What does he do?
So he, you know, joins the Strategic Bombing Survey. He works on that for a while. He publishes his report. Then he's brought back to the State Department.
I remember you said he was very disappointed that his report didn't have a great impact.
I know. So
he's very important.
He reads a report about the war, and he thinks, you know, everybody's going to read it. It's so fascinating, all these incredible, you know, things he's learned about Japan. And he puts it out there, and nobody cares. And he lobbies Congress. I remember reading these letters where he says, you know, here's my report. I've enclosed a whole lot of fresh salmon, you know. And nobody gets back to me. There's not a single letter from anybody who cares. It's just it goes into a complete abyss. Mm-hmm. It's like Kennan's earlier writings where nobody notices. You have to get the timing right. You have to get lucky, and nobody. And it's, you know, Nitze doesn't write like Kennan, not in the same order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. So the report, it just disappears, and he's bummed out. Mm-hmm. So his rise is slower than Kennan. You know, Kennan is meteoric. You know, there's this moment where he's nobody, and there's a moment where he's somebody. And Nitze kind of crawls his way up, works in the State Department. He's a good numbers man because he's worked on Wall Street, economic experience. He works on the economics of the Marshall Plan. He spends a lot of time lobbying for the Marshall Plan, not lobbying, or testifying for the Marshall Plan in front of Congress. It's a very important experience for him, days on end about how many pulses we should send to Austria. So he's involved in these decisions, and he gradually works his way up. And then, in the spring of 1949, Kennan, still head of the policy planning staff, says, let's make this smart economist guy, Paul Nitzer, the deputy. And so at that moment, Nitzer and Kennan work together. They're the top two policy planners under under Acheson.
Mm-hmm. And how do they get along? What do they do?
They get along wonderfully. They had actually met in 1943 on a train, between New York and Washington. Nitzer is a social guy, and he saw Kennan and sat down across from him, and they started chatting, and they had a good conversation. They remembered each other. You know, they had worked also a little bit in 1948 trying to come up with policy towards Germany. And then 49, they get along swimmingly for quite some time until August of 1949, and that's the demarcation line. That's the moment where Nitzer and Kennan split, and they split philosophically, and they set the pattern by which they'll live for the rest of their lives. And what happens then is Stalin sets off an atomic bomb. So the monopoly is over. Mm-hmm. Right? We no longer have a monopoly on nuclear weapons. So the question is, what are we going to do? And Truman says to Acheson, what do we do? Are we going to build a hydrogen bomb? How do we counter this? Acheson says, I don't know. Calls to Nitzer and Kennan and says, what are we going to do? Are we going to build a hydrogen bomb? And so Nitzer and Kennan then take that question, and they have completely different answers, and they come to it in completely different ways. Kennan disappears into this quiet office and thinks. And he writes this amazing 79-page paper. Describes, you know, we build a hydrogen bomb. The Soviets will follow. And they, too, will build a hydrogen bomb. And then we'll build something else. And they will build something else. And then we will have this nuclear arms race. And we'll be unable to think rationally about foreign policy because we'll be obsessed with nuclear weapons. And it's this amazing essay. It quotes St. Paul. It quotes Shakespeare. It's wonderful. But it's also completely, totally, and utterly useless because he comes out with this at the end of December 49. The decision has to be made pronto. No one's going to read this paper. And by this point, Paul Nitzer, who has a much simpler syllogism, which is, are the Soviets going to try to build a hydrogen bomb? Yes. If they try to build a hydrogen bomb and if they succeed, will that be bad for us? Yes. Therefore, we need to try to build a hydrogen bomb first. And he takes that simple syllogism and he works the bureaucracy. He convinces these people. He goes to these meetings. And he learns how to become an inside player. And his argument, of course, wins the day, not just because of him. There are all sorts of other people pushing this. But Nitzer played a role in convincing Acheson. Acheson is part of this, you know, crucial three-person committee that Truman has set up with Lilienthal and Secretary of Defense Johnson to see, should we build this hydrogen bomb? He knows that Lilienthal will be against and that Johnson will be in favor. So Acheson is the tiebreaker. Nitzer has a very important role in Acheson. So the group tells Truman our recommendation is we build it. There's a meeting that lasts 7 minutes. Now, you can't read a 79-page paper in 7 minutes, where we decide to go ahead with the hydrogen bomb. And that is the moment where Kennan has sort of he's lost all of his influence. He's lost, you know, the capacity to kind of work the bureaucracy. And from then on, he's an outsider. He will, you know, the rest of the Cold War, he will play the role of the sage, the dissident, the man who can see into the future, who can see what's going to happen, and who will write these amazing essays that will be beautiful to read, that will be brilliantly conceived of, and will not have much effect. Mm-hmm. And Nitzer will become the insider. He'll become the bureaucrat's bureaucrat. He'll be the man who works for every president, from Roosevelt to Bush. Mm-hmm. And he'll be working this, working that layer. He will never rise into the cabinet, but he will always be there. He'll always be around, always pushing things.
Mm-hmm. I did want to mention or talk to you a little bit about, because I haven't read the literature, about what people think today about the Long Telegram and the X article that followed.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember learning about them and reading about them and doing some research about them, but you know, as I look back upon them, though they might be beautifully written, some of the metaphors in them, particularly the wind-up toy metaphor, is crude beyond conception. He says, just to remind our listeners, he says at one point that the Soviets are a little bit like a wind-up toy. And they'll just go in a certain direction until you put your hand in front of the wind-up toy, and it stops and go in a different direction then. I don't know if it's a very good metaphor, but it certainly was an influential metaphor. So what do people think today about the Long Telegram and about the X article? Did you read some of that literature?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, today they're read mostly as historical documents and people, trying to understand, how policy changed. And they're not read as sort of policy prescriptions to help us understand what we should do in Iran or Afghanistan. But the big debate and the really important debate surrounding them that sort of went on through the Cold War and that still continues to a certain degree is, what did Kennan mean? Kennan talks about containment. And he says, we need to contain the Soviet Union. We need a policy of, long-term vigilant containment. And we need to put our hand in front of the wind-up dog. And the question is whether he meant we should do that by using political means, things like the Marshall Plan, where if we see the Soviets are going to move into Western Europe, we should try to build up France and Germany, or we should manipulate elections in Italy if we think the Russians are going, the communists are going to win there. Is it all political actions, you know, covert action, or did he mean military? Did he mean that the way you put your hand in front of that dog is you build a whole bunch of bombs? And the early interpretation, so Kennan writes, he writes the X article in Foreign Affairs, publishes it on the name X, and he doesn't describe what he really means by containment or how we should carry it out. So it's defined by other people. It's defined, you know, in large part by Walter Lippmann, who defines it as a military doctrine. And then as it's implemented in the U.S. government, it's certainly defined as a military doctrine. Paul Nitzer says, you know, containment is a great idea. The way you contain the Soviets is you have more weapons, and then they won't, you know, then the wind-up dog will stop. So the big debate, though, is not how we implemented it. We clearly implemented it as a military doctrine. The big sort of historical debate and the one where people dig into tea leaves is what did Kennan mean? Did he mean it as a political document or did he mean it as a military document? And he would always claim he meant it just as a political document, but there are all sorts of debates about, well, actually in his speech he's very militarist. Yeah. He said this and he said that. So that's one of the things that scholars are still hashing over.
Mm-hmm. No, I find it all very interesting because one of the, I guess, cliches that I think Kennan is responsible for in the development of Russian studies or Soviet studies in the United States is the notion that somehow the Russians are inherently, intrinsically, or natively imperialistic, that they are always aiming at expansion. And he seems to say he reads this from Russian history, but as somebody that has studied a lot of Russian history, I see what he means, and I see what the appearance is, but it seems to me a kind of odd position. It was very influential at the time, and it seemed to explain what was going on, that there was something about the Russians that made them desire foreign territories. A peculiar, and I don't think correct, statement of Soviet interest at the time. But in any event,
I think a lot of Russian scholars feel the same way, that Kennan, you know, had this wrong or had this wrong. But it's also true that he wrote it in this amazing language, and he knew vastly more than anybody else at the top of U.S. government. So they saw this and said, okay, this guy gets Russian history.
Yeah, no, he did. It's really true. So let's talk about – so really the person who has an impact on policy after this point is Nitzer. Nitzer starts to be the kind of driver behind these things. And how is he influential in the formation of the Truman Doctrine and the events that followed?
Well, you know, he doesn't play a real role in formulating the Truman Doctrine. I mean, that's a little before he comes to power. But – you know, by 1950, I mean, where he really, the first document that he's extremely important at is NSC 68, and that's the document that says the Soviets have this design to take over the world. We need to thwart them, and we need to vastly increase our military budget. You know, he would advocate, you know, he didn't put a number in the document because he knew that would put it to basically set a target on it. He wanted to quadruple the military budget from $13 billion to $50 billion. And he writes this document arguing why we should do that. The document is sort of put aside, but then the Korean War starts, and then it's adopted. We do, in fact, quadruple our military budget. And so NHTSA is associated with this huge buildup of the American armed forces, which begins, you know, after the buildup and the wind-down after World War II, begins again in the spring of 1950, in the summer of 1950. So that's the most important thing he does under Truman. He also plays a role in guiding Korean War policy, actually with Kennan. Kennan comes back into government, and you know, they agree that too much power has been given to MacArthur. They get the Korean War, do it quite accurately, and they know when things are going to fall apart. And so then he stays on through the rest of the Truman administration, helping guide policy towards Iran, for example. And he definitely wants to stay on in Eisenhower, but he's kicked out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting period, that early period of 1950.
Yeah,
because in a sense, Kennan's career is as a diplomat is over. He had quite a brief moment in the sun.
It's a very brief moment. There's sort of 4 years in the 40s, and he comes back and he's ambassador to Moscow for a few months before he, you know, screws up, denounces Moscow and is declared persona non grata. And then he comes back in the Kennedy administration as ambassador to Yugoslavia for 2 years, and then he resigns. He's sort of dissatisfied. And that's it. That's his service.
He's kind of a prickly person, isn't he? I mean, I think that in his annual performance review they give you in corporations, I'm sure you get these too.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't work well with others might come up. You know,
yeah, Kennan never worked. I mean, that's a big difference between Kennan. Is that Kennan never worked well with others. Kennan was best when he was alone writing and thinking, and he certainly liked doing that the most, and he always wanted more time to be alone and to write and to think, and he just kind of messed it up every time he was working with people. But I don't want to say that Kennan wasn't influential after he left government. He didn't have sort of policy on, he didn't have influence on this policy that day. But he is, you know, profoundly influential in shaping public opinion. There's a whole climate of opinion around Kennan, the ideas, you know, for many, you know, throughout the rest of the Cold War. He's a very important person, even if he's not the guy in the room saying we should do this and not that.
What year was NSC 68?
That's the spring of 1950.
Yeah, I've actually read that document almost cover to cover, and it's worth reading because
it is worth reading.
It's truly amazing document.
Very intense.
Incredibly strident in its language.
I remember the first time I read that, and I read it as a student. And I remember thinking
it basically says that the Soviets are just trying to take over the world, and they'll do anything they can to do it. And you know, American civilization is at peril. I mean, it uses language just like that.
Absolutely.
Truly. Really, absolutely undiplomatic language, if I can call it that.
Yeah,
totally undiplomatic language. What did Kennan think of it?
You know, I've never found a specific reaction to Kennan where he talks about NSC 68, but he certainly talks about it in sort of generic terms, where he just says he's got everything wrong. You know, I mean, NHTSA doesn't cast the Soviet Union as a wind-up toy dog that you can stop and put in your hand, and he casts it as sort of a barking Rottweiler that will bite off your hand and you need to claw it backwards. So it's a very different interpretation of what the Soviets were like.
Yeah, I see. So then let's move on into the sort of later 50s and 60s. And
yeah.
What's interesting, one of the things interesting about NHTSA, especially what you say, is that he's always very close to getting a kind of very prominent public role in an administration or a cabinet or being appointed Secretary of Defense, but he never is. Why is that?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is just that you know, even if you work for 10 administrations, how many shots do you have? And there's always a certain randomness. Like, at a certain point, McNamara was just a better Secretary of Defense candidate. So there were certain randomness. But it's also true that he probably could have. And one reason he didn't is that he never was fully on anybody's team. He was always this is a great virtue and a great weakness of him. He was always entirely independent. He was always sort of his own party of one. He was never really on the Democrat side or really on the Republican side. So he never was completely trusted. He also had this funny tick, which is something everybody I interviewed said, and that is that when you're 25 and you talk to Paul Nitzer, he treats you as an equal, and that's amazing. It's great. And I remember this as a grandchild. You know, you question him on something, and he won't say you're a fool and not going to talk to you. He will say, okay, let's address that question, let's deal with it. And that's great when you're a subordinate and when you're younger. But he also treated presidents that way. So Jimmy Carter has an issue. He wouldn't say, oh, you know, Mr. President, of course, you know, you are so sage. He would say, aha, well, let's deal with that. You're wrong on this, wrong on this, wrong on that. Uh-huh. And he was just sort of congenitally unable to be subservient. And so he alienated people. And he constantly wanted to be in the cabinet, and he never made it.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. So both of them, neither of them really dealt very well with people in a way. But I kind of get, if I can stereotype a little bit, it seems to me that NHTSA was sort of a hail fellow well met, you know, kind of a backslapping type, a serious-minded guy, a doer and not a thinker. Whereas Kennan, he kind of withdraws into a sort of monastic cell, doesn't he? I mean, when does he go to the Institute for Advanced Studies? And
well, he goes there in the 50s, and he's sort of there off and on from the 50s until.
And for those people who don't know what the Institute for Advanced Studies is, it is the closest thing to an academic monastery. I mean, it's kind of in the woods in Princeton, and it's like one of these sort of self-sustaining. I want to think like, you know, sort of moon base or something. You know, they have their own clean food, water there, and books and a library and the whole nine yards. You really never have to leave. It's got its own compound. And the help knows not to talk to you. And it's like that.
Perfect. It was perfect for George Kennan. He could take long walks in the woods and think and talk with Robert Oppenheimer.
Right. Exactly. So did he? You know, he became a sort of. I guess I don't know how to say it, but he became kind of an ideological or literary darling of the of the kind of New York publishing set because he's always there. He gets published in all the right places, and he publishes these books that are well regarded. I don't know if they're well read, but they win prizes. There's a difference.
They are fairly well read. I mean, his American Diplomacy, his memoirs are read widely.
I did. You know, it's funny you mentioned this because I. The very reason that I went to college in the first place and studied what I do today is because of a book he wrote, which was Russia and the West under Lenin and Stalin.
Well, there you go. I mean, there are lots of people who say that.
I read that book when I was 17. I think it was the first book I ever read, to be honest with you.
I mean, they're amazing writers.
I read it, and I was like, this is really cool.
He's a poet. He writes these incredible character sketches. He's a great sense of drama and narrative.
It was interesting. I don't know how that book got to where I was in Kansas. That's a very – I don't know why. My parents had about three books, and that was one of them. I don't know why the hell they had that book.
That's
it was
awesome.
A hardcover blue book. I remember this very well. And I think I talked about it in my application letter for college. And
well,
so
great.
Hats off to George Kennan. And then when I was in college, I actually met George Kennan once. I met him twice in my life, and I don't really have any recollections of it either time. He was very old the second time I met him. So so let's talk a little bit about NHTSA, and particularly about what was it called? I'm sorry, Team B, is that right? I always forget this. Yeah, Team B. What is Team B?
So Team B is a very important episode. So we get to the late 1970s, and NHTSA has been denied by the Carter administration. Actually, no, this is before the Carter administration. Sorry. So this is November of 76, and he's fought with the Ford administration. He believes that America is sort of selling out to the Soviets and that the Soviets have, for the first time in his life, moved far ahead of us in terms of nuclear arsenal. And this matters to him, not because he's convinced there's a war, but because he thinks there'll be a conflict, and it might be over Berlin, it might be over Turkey. But he has this fundamental belief, it's one of the most important beliefs that he carries throughout his life, and that is, whoever has larger nuclear arsenal and whoever thinks they can win an all-out war will win in a small conflict. And he thinks that's the lesson from Cuba, that the Soviets backed away because we had a large arsenal. It's the lesson of the Berlin Crisis of 61. So we get to the 70s, and he's convinced that the Soviets are going to have more leverage than us. And so he starts this group called the Committee of the Present Danger, which lobbies against the SALT II Treaty. And then he's brought in this thing called the Team B exercise, and it starts in about August of 76. So he's brought in George Bush as head of the CIA, and NHTSA and a group of other people, including Richard Pipes, we talked about earlier, are brought in, and their job is to analyze the CIA reports on the Soviet Union and ask the question, is the CIA underestimating Soviet strength? Mm-hmm. And the answer, of course, is yes. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about this is that NHTSA and Pipes and these others come to the conclusion that the CIA is underestimating. This is why the CIA analysts are called Team A, NHTSA and Pipes, et cetera, called Team B. And there's this famous meeting that happens a couple days after the election in 76. And the CIA analysts, these young guys in their 30s who are satellite data on the Soviet Union, this is what kind of silos they're building. This is, you know, the bus and bomber they've got. And they sit down at a table, and they're expecting kind of a friendly conversation with the Team B people about, you know, what they've got wrong, what to discuss, you know, after back. And instead, it's this incredibly fierce fight. It's a fierce fight where NHTSA, Pipes, and these seasoned conservatives just shred the young CIA analysts. Somebody will later say that it's like, you know, Walt Whitman High School versus the Washington Redskins. And it's just brutal. And NHTSA, you know, bites the head off these young CIA analysts. And so it's a very harsh moment. And then the news of this news of the existence of Team B is leaked, and it creates this whole firestorm. And it, you know, brings up this big debate about CIA estimates of Soviet strength. It's a very, very interesting moment, which has a lot of other twists and turns in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Team B was very important because actually the whole Ford administration was very important.
For
the later Reagan administration, actually. And then
right.
Yeah, so very important. Maybe you could take us into the Reagan administration with NHTSA. What was NHTSA doing in the 80s?
Sure. So NHTSA, he spends the late 1970s as the uber hawk, the man who brings down the SALT II Treaty. Reagan comes into office, and he respects NHTSA's knowledge of nuclear weapons, and he appoints him to be head of arms control, the chief arms negotiator at INF. And this is just preposterous to people on the left. You know, Barbara Tuchman says that making Paul NHTSA head of arms control is like making the Pope the head of abortion rights. NHTSA doesn't know how to control arms. But he comes in, and he's in his late 70s, it's early 80s, so it's late 70s at this point. He comes in and he actually does want deals. He's at the end of his career. And he's also scared. He's worried that the Atlantic Alliance is fraying because of the nuclear issue. And he's worried that, his friends in Germany, that there will be a revolution in Germany, or there will be a decay in the German political system. And so he really does try to make a deal, and he works. He goes, that famous moment where he goes and walks into the woods with his Soviet counterpart. They tear up and throw away all their negotiating instructions. They sit down on a log in the rain, and the two of them work out their own deal. And they bring it back, and of course they're both crushed by their bureaucracies. But that is, it's a Hail Mary effort at, breaking the logjam in arms negotiations that NHTSA pushes. Then at Reykjavik 4 years later, NHTSA stays up all night, 79 years old, pulls an all-nighter trying to solve these issues that he's been working on since 1945. And he gets so close and desperately wants a deal, and then it falls through, and he's crushed, and there's a press conference. There's an incredible photo of him, tears coming down. We tried, my God, we really tried. And so, in some ways, at this moment, it seems like he spent his whole life building up to this crescendo, this climax, this final moment, Reykjavik, where everything he's worked on will be resolved, and then it falls apart. But of course, as we all know, it doesn't actually mean that much, because the Soviet Union disappears in 4 years, and it's hailed as a hero.
Yeah, that's right. So did Did Nitze and Kennan have a rapprochement at this moment? I mean, because you would think that Kennan would sort of like this. What was going on?
Well, they have a sort of personal rapprochement, and they both, you know, they're very friendly to each other. They see each other. You know, Nitze has this wonderful, comes up to Kennan's 80th birthday party, gives a wonderful toast. But the actual rapprochement, the one that, you know, inspired this book, and that was the first moment where I realized there could be, there was interesting history of Nitze and Kennan, is in 1999. And that's, Cold War's over. Nitze writes an op-ed in the New York Times. He says, you know what? We don't actually need these weapons anymore. You know, conventional weapons will be fine for any future conflict, so let's just get rid of them. And then I was at his house 2 weeks later, and he gets this letter from Kennan. And the letter reads something like, "Dear Paul, I read your op-ed in today's New York Times. I agree with every word. Isn't it nice that after 50 years, we finally find ourselves in accord on matters that meant so much in years gone by?" And, you know, incredible letter. You can tell the personal history and, you know, the warmth in it. And it just, that sort of planted the seed that 5 years later, the two of them die. Very similar moment. It was a little bit like Jefferson and Adams. And,
wow, that's a great
and when that happened, I thought back to the letter, and I thought, oh, you could have a book.
Yeah, that's a great story. So let me, we're almost out of time, but let me ask you a couple more questions. One of them is,
sure.
What are your personal recollections of Nitze? I mean, he was your grandfather, and I imagine you have a lot to say, but what kind of a fellow was he?
Well, you know, he was a wonderful fellow. I can't think of any political conversations I've had that, you know, sort of stuck with me, because by the time I was old enough to understand these things and to learn about these things, he was kind of too old, just checking out. But he, you know, from my childhood, we had a great time. We'd go fishing together. We'd go skiing. He was a great skier up to his 80s. We used to play in parent-child tennis tournaments where he would sort of sub in as my grandfather, and we would, you know, play. There's a moment where I was probably when I was 10 and he was about 80, where our skills kind of matched. We got sort of great tennis matches, and then, you know, I sort of got better. He sort of got a little older, and we would still play. I mean, even at the end of his life, I remember we played tennis, and he would put a chair at the baseline. He'd stand up and hit a ball, and then sort of sit down. And then I would hit one back to him, and he would stand up and hit it again, and he'd sit down. So we had this wonderful sort of friendly relationship. He was, you know, for as hard as he worked, and as important as these issues were, and, you know, to some people, as profoundly wrong as he was on, you know, the great matters of policy, he was without question just a lovely person to be around and a charming, you know, fantastic grandfather. And that actually, you know, besides making this book interesting to me, I mean, of course, it's a problem because you have to write an objective biography. So you can't let your, you know, love and personal feelings of this man overshadow the moments where you think he's wrong. So you have to be, the greatest sort of narrative challenge for me was being clinically detached while writing it. But my personal memories of him, I think, also, you know, helped me get interested in this book, because the Paul Nitze who's described in so many contemporary histories as kind of a shallow demon, you know, the man who, like, the dark soul of the Pentagon. And there are several books that have come out that have cast him that way. And if I hadn't known him, if I hadn't had a personal connection, and I had just sort of read the major histories of the, you know, contemporary histories of the Cold War, I might never have realized how interesting and complicated he was. So Kennan, everybody knows, is interesting and complicated. Nitze, I think, partly by having a personal connection to him, knew that he was interesting and complicated.
Well, I mean, I want to thank you, and on the part of the future readers or current readers of the book, I think I should thank you for bringing Nitze to light. A lot has been written about Kennan, as you say, but I didn't know as much about Nitze, and I'm very happy to know it now. He did have a truly remarkable life, it's and the book is worth reading. If you just read the Nitze parts, you could. So
you should read the Kennan parts.
Yeah, read the Kennan parts too, of course. No, it's a terrific book, and I was really pleased. Again, I bring a certain perspective to it because I know quite a bit about Kennan, but the Nitze part I thought was absolutely fascinating. And Team B was very important, and so was, you know, this business with the Germans after the war. All of it really very, very interesting. And there's another particular moment that I was glad that you brought up, and that is that, you know, Nitze's report on whether it was necessary to drop the atomic bomb to get the Japanese to surrender. Really interesting stuff there. And I think a lot to be learned from what he has to say and why he said it. I think you have the right analysis there. But I'd heard about this before, and so I was happy to read about it. So let me thank you for writing the book. Let me also ask you our traditional final question here on New Books in History, and that is, what are you doing now? What's on your plate?
I'm an editor at Wired, so I'm editing stories about technology, and I'm now a contributing editor at Bloomberg TV, so I do a lot of technology analysis on TV. And I'm trying to find the next great book. So if anybody has a brilliant idea for a dual biography where I can have, you know, amazing access to exclusive documents that reveal, you know, dark characters, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm looking for the next. I would love to find another book. I don't know what it is.
Right. Well, I mean, it's very refreshing for me to hear you say that, because I think I've done about 100 of these interviews now with people that have written history books and professional historians. And you are the first person to say, I'm not sure. So kudos to you. I think that's great. Keep an open mind about what you're going to do next. Let me tell our listeners that we've been talking to Nicholas Thompson about his book, The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Nicholas, thanks very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Marshall. That was great fun.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Nicholas Thompson about his new book, The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.